Welcome back to From the Press Box, the Holland Sentinel Sports Desk weekly podcast, where we talk anything and everything sports. I'm sports editor Dan Diodana, along with our assistant sports editor, Will Kennedy. And we got a lot to discuss today. We've got Zealand native Jim Cott's Hall of Fame chances. That's votes coming up Sunday. We'll talk about that. High school basketball has tipped off. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. But we got to start with the game, Will. I mean, Michigan, Ohio State, that was just a stunning thing. I mean, I never thought that they had that much of a shot to win, and the way that Michigan dominated Ohio State at the line was just incredible. What was your take on that game?
Yeah, I mean, I think I said all last week that Michigan had no chance unless they did a couple things. That would be the only way they have a chance, is they need to get the run game going. They need to limit the amount of times Cade McNamara put it in the air, which they did. And they had to dominate up front on the offensive line of scrimmage, and they really had to dominate on the defensive line of scrimmage, because if you gave C.J. Stroud any sort of semblance of a pocket, he was going to find a wide-open receiver, because their three receivers are just so good. And all those three things came to fruition. I think the weather certainly helped in Michigan's favor. But, yeah. I mean, the reason they won that game was Aiden Hutchinson and David Ojabo on the defensive ends. They just were in C.J. Stroud's pocket all night or all afternoon. Didn't give him any time to find a person. And, you know, when he did have a moment, to find someone, he found a wide open receiver 95% of the time. And so if those two guys, Ojabo and Hutchinson weren't there, then, the game could have got ugly, I think. But, you know, the Michigan kind of knew what their game plan was and stuck to it. And like I said, the weather helped them, being not great and snowy. That kind of gives you a kind of ground and pound mentality from the start. And that worked in their favor. You know, Hassan Haskins played great. And Blake Corum is a little bit of a change of pace back. He really popped off too. And it was fun to watch, especially my mom's a huge Michigan fan. She's from Detroit. And she was about to have a heart attack during that game. They're up 15 with like 2 minutes left. And she's like, "Oh, we're going to blow it. I know we're going to blow it. I've seen this so many times." I'm like, "Mom, they're going to win. What are you talking about?" She was legitimately about to have a heart attack. It was really funny.
That is funny.
No, it was incredible. And, you know, I would just be worried if I were a Michigan fan that, you know, yeah, you got the monkey off your back and you're feeling all good. But, you know, Iowa's offense is bad, but they got a really good defense this week really in Indianapolis. Good. So don't just buy your tickets to the playoff just yet. You got to take care of business in Indy this week.
For sure. For sure. The thing that impressed me the most about the defensive ends that you're talking about, particularly Hutchinson, is it seemed like not only obviously they dominated the line of scrimmage and disrupted a lot of things, but it seemed like they made their biggest plays at the biggest moments.
Oh yeah.
And especially late in the fourth, when Ohio State was still in it before Michigan got the 2-score lead. You know, they had like, I don't know if they had back-to-back sacks or a sack and then a knockdown or whatever. And it was just right when you thought, oh, maybe this is when your mom was like, "Oh, they're going to blow." Then they had two plays back to back that just sucked any momentum away that Ohio State was building with the drive. And it was just really, incredible to watch. And I had somebody ask me if I thought Hutchinson should be a finalist for the Heisman Trophy.
Absolutely should be.
And after this game, and also based on the fact that there's no clear-cut favorite.
If there's any year
– I would agree.
If there's any year for a defensive player to win the Heisman, it's this year.
Right. There's no clear-cut favorite offensively. There's, you know, maybe three guys that have kind of gone back and forth a little bit this year, but they've all – they've had their moments. They've not performed – I mean, Alabama's quarterback did not perform that well against Auburn. Obviously, Ohio State's quarterback did not perform as well against Michigan.
Yeah.
Michigan State's Walker he disappeared in the Ohio State game because Ohio State was outplaying them so much. But in contrast to them, Hutchinson has had his biggest moments in the biggest games.
Yeah.
And has completely disrupted things and dominated on the defensive side of the ball. And I think that – I think he should be a finalist at least. I think that would be incredible. I think it would be really cool if Michigan and Michigan State had finalists at the same time. Also, I'm not really sure if that's ever happened before. Probably I don't really know. I would guess not. I mean, so that would be pretty cool as well. But just I feel like it would be a good acknowledgement by the committee too that defense matters. And I think that I know there's defensive awards and everything like that, but if the best player and the most dominant player in college football is on the defensive side, it should be them. And now this is not like I did. Now, don't get me wrong. I growing up, my whole family went to Michigan. I did not go to Michigan. I was a Michigan fan as a kid. I really, as a, you know, being a sports editor has really leveled my I'm not a fan anymore, but I don't dislike them. You know what I mean? I'd root for both Michigan and Michigan State or the better story as a journalist. But when I was a kid, Charles Woodson won the Heisman. I never thought he would win the Heisman. Now, don't get me wrong. I knew he was the most electric player in the game, but Peyton Manning was that year. Like, I really couldn't believe that he won the Heisman Trophy over Peyton Manning that year, which was, you know, incredible. I mean, looking back, I can. But the fact that it had really never happened before and there was a really great quarterback that was a front runner, I was really surprised by that. So I think this – I agree with you. I think if there's ever another year for it to be a defensive player, it's this year. And I, you know, if they keep going, if they beat Iowa and they make it into the playoff and then even win one of the playoff games and end up in the championship game, win or lose, if he's still having big games, Hutchinson's having big games getting there, how could you not vote for him?
Well, and the thing is for me, like the Heisman, like it's become construed as like this offensive award because an offensive player always wins it, or like a quarterback always wins it, or a wide receiver last year or something always wins it. But like, if you look at the top four teams in college football this year, who are right now, what, Georgia, Alabama, Michigan, and Cincy. I mean, you can't win the Heisman if you're not the best player on your team. And all the best players on those teams are all defensive guys. Like right. Jordan Davis at Georgia is like 6'7", 380 pounds, and is just an absolute unit. Will Anderson at Alabama has like 30 tackles for loss and like 14 sacks. If you take away his sacks, he has more tackles for loss than anybody else in the country still, which is absurd. Obviously, Aiden Hutchinson, David Ojabo on the Lions for Michigan. And then for Cincy, their entire defense is fantastic. That's how they're winning games. That's how a group of five team is going to make the playoffs, because they have defensive guys like a cornerback, Ahmad Gardner, Sauce Gardner, who has more touchdowns than he does touchdowns allowed, who's as a defensive back, which is just absurd. He got a fifth one this year or this past week. So, I mean, if there's ever a year for it to be a defensive guy, it's going to be it, because you mentioned the quarterback from Alabama. Yeah, he's good, but he's not even the best player on his team, so he can't win the Heisman in my mind.
Right, I would agree with you on that. That should be a determining factor.
If you're not the best player on your team, you can't win the Heisman. You shouldn't be able
right.
to win the
Heisman. And if you have a bunch of defensive guys that are in the running,
now I
don't. It's going to be the one that people remember for the big moments.
And I mean, I don't think Aiden Hutchinson should win the Heisman. I think he should be in New York City. I think he's earned a spot in New York City, but I don't think he'll win it. I think Jordan Davis from Georgia should win it. I mean, that dude is just absurd.
Right.
But that's me. And also, that's not going to happen because voters are like, well, I don't have the stats for defense, and it's not the same. Right. You can't tangibly put it there. It's like, well, just watch the games.
Right. I mean, I think that there's a chance that they have a defensive player in New York in live, but there should be three.
There should be multiple, yeah.
Yeah, and I just don't see that happening. No. But it should. And that would be
the last time a defensive player was even in New York, like Manti Te'o in 2013.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
I think that's the last time.
That was a while ago. Yeah. I don't know of anybody else since then. I mean, there was a few years after Woodson where I feel like people looked at defenders more. And so you had a couple, you know, but
What year was Ndamukong Suh? I feel like that was like maybe 09 or 10 or something. That's the year he should have won the Heisman. If there's ever a year for a defensive player to win the Heisman that didn't, it's Ndamukong Suh.
Right.
He had just an absolutely absurd season that year for Nebraska. But I think Te'o was the most recent solely defender. Like, there have been defensive/special teams guys, but the last pure defender to make it, I think it's Manti Te'o, which is a long time ago. I was in high school.
Right. It was quite a while ago. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. They got Michigan's got Iowa this week. Yep. Speaking of defensive ends, one of Iowa's starting defensive ends is Zach Van Valkenburgh from Zeeland West. He was All Big Ten last year. He's having another great year this year. You know, it's just they had a couple of bumps in the road, but they really, as I know you mentioned this about the Michigan game, as the weather gets worse, Iowa gets better.
Yeah.
Because their defense runs the game.
Yeah.
It controls the entire game, every game they've played. And, you know, the colder it gets, the less, I mean, I know this will be an indoor game.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a little bit different, but like it, that's how they've done it this year though. And it was impressive to watch how their defense single-handedly beat Nebraska.
Yeah.
Fittingly, Ben Valkenburg was the one they got to grab the interstate trophy or whatever and raise that up.
I think they had like one offensive touchdown that game, or if they did have one, it was like a set up by a turnover that came at the 1 yard line.
Right.
I watched part of that game and then I was like, oh, it's 24-0 Nebraska, 24-7. We're like, this game's over. You're like, good for you. Stop for us. Like, you're turning it around. And then I just see people on my timeline talking about Nebraska's blowing it. And I was like, oh no, not again.
Right.
I don't know how much of that was Iowa or just Nebraska being notorious for blowing.
I mean, they blocked a punt, scored it. They did a lot of things.
Yeah, they did a lot of things.
Got a fumble and scored it. It was just their offense is not good. So no, like
it's I would argue and say it's bad. It's bad.
It's so like against Michigan, like and that, but this is like the fear of a hangover game or a trap game because
that's what I'm saying. Yeah,
Iowa's defense is good enough to stop Michigan's offense.
Absolutely. Iowa's defense is a lot better than Ohio State's defense.
Right. So that is going to make points at a premium for Michigan.
Yeah.
However, Michigan's offense should, I mean, Michigan's defense should and could shut Iowa out.
Oh, yeah. Michigan's defense should have, if Iowa scores more than 10 points on offense alone, like not counting like pick sixes or something like that, or even like short fields. If Iowa gets the ball off a punt or a kickoff and can go down the field and score more than 10 points in this game, I'll be stunned.
Yeah.
Like they can't.
It's going to be interesting. It's definitely going to be a different kind of game. I mean, I'm picturing like 17-0.
I think 13-0,
something like that.
I'm not like a betting man by any sense of the word. I don't gamble, but I think I saw the spread was like Michigan minus 10.5. I would bet on Iowa for that. I don't think Iowa's going to get blown out.
Sure, it's a better money return style bet. I mean,
I think Michigan will win as long as they take it seriously and their offense does what they need to do. But I don't think it's going to be a blowout by any means.
No, maybe. I mean, I should give Iowa's defense credit for that. They've been good enough that they can avoid a shutout on their own on the defensive side. So
yeah, Iowa's defense.
Maybe 17-7.
That I can see that. Maybe
something like that.
Maybe like 21-10. I know that goes against what I just said at 10.5, but like something like that. Maybe 13-21.
But on the flip side, if Iowa gets the ball first and somehow puts together a scoring drive, alarms should be raised everywhere.
Absolutely.
Because the defense could shut them out the rest of the game. And that's it's kind of what Michigan did to Ohio State. They went, marched down and scored right away. And everybody's like, oh, maybe Michigan's got a shot.
Yeah.
So
that's what
it'll be very exciting. I'm glad Iowa's in it. I'm glad it's not a rematch against Wisconsin. I think because they haven't played Iowa in a couple of years.
Wisconsin is overrated to begin with.
I think that's a good I think it's good for the Big Ten, you know, that it's not a rematch of a lopsided game.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's got, you know, two of the best defenses, I think is going to be really exciting. It's one of those games that you worry about national ratings because there's going to be like no scoring. But
I think that just the fact that Michigan has a chance to punch a ticket to the playoff is going to make it intriguing. And the whole nation, you either like Jim Harbaugh or you like to hate Jim Harbaugh. So there's really everyone's either going to be rooting for him or rooting against him. So
yeah, nobody hates to hate him. Everyone loves to hate him.
Yeah, exactly. I know it's kind of getting off topic, but how crazy is it that Michigan beats Ohio State for the first time in like 11 years? And that's like the third craziest college football story in the past 4 days with Brian Kelly leaving and Lincoln Riley leaving and all that. Which is just, both of those are stunning, but it's just hilarious. This is why I love this stupid sport. It's so stupid. Right. It's so dumb, but it's
crazy. Well, it's, it's amazing how much action-packed stuff happens in a 12-game season. Like, that's...
Or even a 12-hour period. In a 12-hour period from when Michigan beat Ohio State. Michigan beat Ohio State. Lincoln Riley said at a press conference, I'm not going to be the next head coach at LSU. About 3 hours later, he was the head coach at USC. And then Brian Kelly is just like, yeah, no, I'm going to leave Notre Dame for LSU. While Notre Dame still has a very realistic chance to make the playoff.
Yeah, it was weird timing for that to be announced.
And he's not going to coach. He's not coaching in a playoff game. Even if they made the playoff, he's not going to coach in it. He's done. He's in LSU.
That's insane to me that any coach.
If Oklahoma State, Cincinnati, or Michigan lose, which I think Michigan has a chance to lose. I think Cincinnati has a chance to lose. I think Oklahoma State also has a chance to lose. If any of those three teams lose, Notre Dame is going to make the playoff. Right. And they're going to have an interim head coach in the playoff.
Right, which is so strange. I mean, this is hilarious. I think this is what's wrong in a way with college football. I honestly feel like there should be a rule that you can't hire a coach until the season's over. I've heard plenty of, the opposite end of that article or that argument. Just with amount of time it takes to start fresh in a program and all that kind of stuff, then they need to not have so much time before the bowl games or something. I mean, like, if that's the case, like, there needs, I mean, now there's not, because you have all these conference championship games.
Yeah.
And then it's only a couple of weeks. If you can prove to me what Brian Kelly can do positively to make an actual worthy impact in the next 3 weeks at LSU, instead of coaching his team that he's coached, it should be a rule so that coaches don't have to make that decision. Like,
I mean, the only tangible thing that it could set a program back, because now with the early signing days in the middle of December, even before bowl games. So like,
right,
you get the job at the end of November, you have to rally together to salvage a recruiting class to even make a semblance that you're going to make some sort of dent in year one or year zero or year two, right, as your first year head coach. Because college football is weird. Like, you can come in at year one and your team's going to be bad because it's nothing like what you want it to be. Your roster doesn't fit your needs. It's not like, right, you can be GM in the NFL and go get, I need this, this, and this. Like,
right,
the guys who are there are the guys who are there. And the transfer portal has alleviated that a bit, but it's just, it's the first few weeks of a coach are definitely necessary, and you need to be recruiting really hard. But there are guys like Scott Frost, when he was at Central Florida, he took the Nebraska job the day after the conference title game, maybe even the same day. Yeah, it was the same day because he was in the locker room talking to his guys about it after they won. But he stayed and coached the bowl game with them, but he was on the road recruiting for Nebraska when they weren't practicing. Because you get, like, I think it's 15 practices. When you're not practicing, you're doing your own. Like, they're working on stuff, right, but, like, coaches can be on the road recruiting. So,
right. If it shows the business side of things, that, like, you know, that it's all about the business side of things. Because, like, I mean, you and I have both been a part of teams before. Yeah. To have your coach, especially if you really enjoy playing for the coach, to have them leave before your final game,
it's bad.
It's just bad. Like, they should be able to figure out the recruiting dates differently, or not allow coaches to leave before their season is over or something.
And that's one of the bigger reasons why
they could leave. They could announce that coaches can't hire somebody until after the bowl, like January 1st or something. I don't know.
But
like
the correctors.
Yeah, like, yeah. I see that devaluing the, supposed team aspect of this. And I think that's why Michigan got Rich Rod instead of Les Miles. They offered the job to Les Miles from LSU, and he was in the championship game or the bowl or the Sugar Bowl or something like that. And he said, I've been with this team 12 years or whatever it was. I'm not going to leave them until we finish this. And Michigan just kind of told him to take it or leave it. And he said, no, I'm going to stay. If you can't wait 3 weeks,
probably
then whatever. And then they got Rich Rod and they ended up in this mess.
Well, probably dodged the bullet not getting Les Miles.
Agree. Well, I think both sides of that dodged a bullet. At the time, Les Miles also dodged a bullet. Yeah. It's just,
well, I mean, that's just one of the reasons, like, going back to how coaches don't leave, like, that's one of the reasons why I know Scott Frost has kind of become like a meme in the college football world, like, can't win games, blows leads and everything. that's just one of the reasons why I respect the man so much, is because he was at Central Florida and he stayed through the Peach Bowl, took them on an undefeated season, even after he had accepted the Nebraska job. Like, he had his introductory press conference at Nebraska, had been recruiting at Nebraska, and then came back to Orlando for all the practices and coached them and beat Auburn in the Peach Bowl. And then once he did that, he's like, all right, I'm done. I'm done with UCF. Right. I'm all Nebraska.
But like, yeah, that definitely was the right.
And Billy Napier at Louisiana Lafayette is doing the same thing right now. He's coaching in the Sun Belt title game, but he's already accepted the head coaching job at Florida.
Like, right. I mean, like, otherwise, what do you teach? You're telling any mid-major school that even if you have a great season, your coach will be gone before you get to the end. Like, that's really crappy.
I mean, at this point, it's not even mid-majors, because it's mid-majors or Notre Dame or Oklahoma.
Right.
So,
right.
At this point, it's whoever has the most money.
Right.
So, I don't understand why you leave Notre Dame for LSU, because, you know, LSU is not – I mean, I get they won the national title recently, and it's very easy to recruit
it's
there.
It's that SEC money or something. I don't know.
SEC money, like, easier to recruit. Academic standards aren't as high, but it's just
– still.
You're a top five team in the country perennially.
To me, unless there's some sort of inner turmoil that we don't know, I can't understand why anyone would leave Notre Dame ever.
Oh, it's hard to recruit to Notre Dame. I get that. It's hard to recruit Notre Dame. It's a hard sell getting those kids from South Florida or Texas or something come up and be in the freezing cold wither at this really conservative Catholic school and be a star for 4 months of the year. And then the rest of the 8 months are going to be awful.
Right.
So I can see why you would leave for LSU, where it's just like anybody with a pulse gets accepted. Really great weather all the time. Best athletes in the world get to play in the SEC. Like, absolutely.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's an easier recruit, that's for sure. But it just seems
like that's the whole reason for a coach to leave and get better, easier recruit, better athletes, better turnout on the field. And apologies to anybody who's listening to this who went to LSU. I didn't actually mean it like that. It's just the academic standards are not as rigorous as Notre Dame. I think we can.
Right. I mean, even if LSU is a state school middle of the pack, Notre Dame is in the higher level of academic standards. Interesting for sure. So we'll see what happens in the Big Ten title game, and then beyond. We'll definitely break that down next week. So the other big story this week coming up, the Golden Era ballot vote for the Hall of Fame is Sunday night. Zealand native Jim Cott is a finalist on this ballot again. I won't get it too far into it like I have in the past, as Will has been both shocked, amazed, and maybe disturbed at how much I know about Hall of Fame voting history. But I was into that when I was younger. I did my internship at the Hall of Fame when I was in college, and now an actual Hall of Fame voting issue has been in my crosshairs as a professional since Jim Cott's from Zealand for all these years. So it's definitely been something I paid a lot of attention to. But so the quick basics: the Golden Era Committee meets every 5 years. There's 10 finalists. These are players that have dropped off the writer's ballot, and they have three different eras of the game. This is the Golden Era. That's like it's like from like 1950 to 1973 or something like that. It's like, so, or basically, or 48 to 73. It's like from integration to the advent of the DH, basically. And so Jim Cott's been a finalist on this a bunch. The last time they had a vote, he missed by 2 votes. But also his former teammates, Tony Oliva and Dick Allen, each missed by 1 vote. And then Minnie Minoso, Mr. White Sox, missed by 4 votes. And I think Maury Wills from the Dodgers missed by 3 votes. So there's a lot of candidates that keep eating up each other's votes. The committee of 16 can only vote to up to 4 people each, which is what happens when you have 6 great candidates. Then everybody ends up a vote short, which has been really hard. The only Cubs third baseman Ron Santo is the only person who's been voted in from this era in any shape or form of different committees since 2001. So in 20 years, only one person has made it in this group, which is why the logjam continues, and it's the same finalists every year. So Jim Cott from Zealand, left-handed pitcher, mostly for the Minnesota Twins. He won 16 gold gloves as the best fielding pitcher in the game, which was a record until Greg Maddux broke it. He won 283 games in his career. And would have won the Cy Young Award in, I think, 1966, but the first few years they only did one for all of baseball, not one per league like they do now. He was the best pitcher in the American League in 1966, but Sandy Koufax won the Cy Young with one of his best seasons. So those are his numbers. his, for people who like analytics, his analytics aren't quite as good, which is a reason that his case has just kind of stayed stagnant, is he doesn't have a driving force of the, oh my gosh, these analytics make him look so much better with either WAR or ERA plus or whatever. But he's definitely got a shot. And that vote will be this week. He's got a few teammates, former teammates that are on the committee, which is a good sign, but that also means Tony Oliva and Dick Allen have a few teammates on the committee. So my prediction is that Dick Allen and Tony Oliva, who both missed by one vote 5 years ago, both make it. I would love to see Jim Cott or Minnie Minoso sneak in there as well. I honestly really wouldn't have a problem with any of the 10 guys making it. That's how strong that the ballot is on the field. I mean, the worst person on the ballot is Roger Maris, who broke Babe Ruth's single season home run record and won 2 MVPs. So if that's the worst, I know he had a shorter career, but that's still pretty good. It's pretty good. And when you're talking about fame and famous, that's pretty famous. As a kid, I couldn't believe he wasn't in the Hall of Fame. It just didn't make any sense to me because I didn't really get how they did that. But I'm like, well, if he broke the most hallowed record, how was he not in the Hall of Fame? So we'll see what happens. But having this, having the teammates on there helps. And if maybe he can sneak in as the third person. I would hate to see him miss by one vote. That would just be horrible after missing by two and being so close. I mean, he has consistently told me he doesn't really think about it. He doesn't really care, but I believe him in the fact that he doesn't really care in the fact that he's not living or dying with the moment like some candidates do years after years, which I think is healthy. But at the same time, how can you not be paying attention if you miss by two votes or one vote? I mean, like that's really tough. But he's also consistently said that Tony Oliva, his teammate, and Dick Allen, they both deserve to be in ahead of him. Objectively, I would argue that Jim Cott's probably the fifth, maybe the fifth best, fifth or sixth best candidate on there.
Yeah.
Behind Oliva, Allen, Minnie Minoso, and third baseman Ken Boyer from the Cardinals. But again, like I said, I would have no problem with all 10 being in. That's how crazy we are. The other era committees, I don't necessarily feel that way, but this era has been such a logjam. So we'll see what happens Sunday night, and we'll be back to kind of break down what happened with the voting, you know, at our next podcast as well. But I feel like I've been writing this could be the year about Jim Cott for like 20 years. So I actually just, and Tony Oliva, my dad and I just met him at a sports cards show in Chicago a couple weeks ago, and I, you know, got to get his autograph and shake his hand, and I told him, you know, 2 weeks I think you're gonna be in the Hall of Fame. And which is really funny because the first time I met Tony Oliva was in 1999 when I was at my first Hall of Fame induction ceremony, and he was there as a guest, and I met him then, and I also told him I think you're gonna be in the Hall of Fame soon. That was 1999, so it's that was when I was a senior in high school. So he's been waiting a long time, let's just say that. He had a great career, but it was cut short by injuries, but it was amazing. 3 batting titles, led the league in hits 5 times, you know, was great. It was just short. He was in the argument for best player in the American League in the 60s. So Hall of Fame material in my book, but like I said, I wouldn't have a problem with any of them, but we'll see if Jim Cott from Zealand can kind of sneak in with Tony Oliva and Dick Allen. We'll see how that goes. Jim Cott, Tony Oliva, and Maury Wills are the only 3 of the 10 who are still alive. Dick Allen died the day after the vote was supposed to be last year, but they postponed the in-person thing to this year. So it was actually supposed to be last year, the vote. And Dick Allen died the very next day that it was supposed to be. So, which is awful.
That's very sad.
Like, really awful. So, so hopefully those guys all make it. That would be great. So, Grand Valley's football season over, switching gears. They played Ferris again. The first time they played Ferris State, they lost by a touchdown, and they had a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, this time they arguably outplayed Ferris the first time they played them.
That can definitely not be the case, and that can be said this time. They had 4 or 5 turnovers, but they also couldn't stop anything Ferris did. And Ferris State was ahead by 30 points by halftime, and it just continued to roll. It was just not a great game for the Lakers. unfortunately, it was a very sour ending, but a great, they lost only two games and both of them to the number one team in the country. Yeah. That's still alive, but it's still a team they could have beaten if they played their best.
Absolutely.
So it's just one of those bittersweet things where, you know, it was one of their better seasons they've had in a long time, but they won't feel like it. Especially the way it happened too, with them feeling like they should have won the first time and then just absolutely not having a shot in that second game. So
I think the D2 whole playoff system needs some sort of revamping. That the number one team in the country can play the number five team in the country in the second round seems bizarre, right? and not particularly fair.
Agreed.
But
D3 is like that too, where they do it all regionally.
Yeah. I mean, D3, it makes a little more sense just because there's like, you know, so many D3 teams across the
country. Yeah, there's more schools in D3 than there are in D2 for sure.
Exactly. That's why it makes a bit more sense to regionalize it. But like, I mean, D2 teams, like, these are big budget programs giving out scholarships and stuff. So, you know, make them travel a little bit. Who cares? Make the playoffs more equitable to some degree, you know? Like I said, this is my first time ever covering D2 athletics, so I might just be way off base, but it seems just by the naked eye and just me kind of parachuting in looking at it, it seems a bit bizarre that the number five team in the country would have to play the number one team in the country in the second round of the playoffs.
Agreed. Especially knowing that they've already played each other in a close game too.
Yeah, I mean like that wouldn't happen in an NCAA basketball tournament. They wouldn't meet till like the Sweet 16 at a minimum.
Right. Right. So yeah, it'll be interesting. And also there's a lot of scuttlebutt that Grand Valley's looking to go D1 in the next couple of years. So that would be a game changer in a lot of ways as well. They definitely have, I mean, they have the size and most of the athletic facilities have been updated. They have the ability to do that. And they have as many students as most of the MAC schools around.
Yeah.
It's just that last step is a big one.
They would certainly go FCS instead of FBS in football. I imagine.
Yes. They would go FCS. But that would also make them, that would change everything for the other sports too, which would be interesting.
Oh yeah. That's a sport where it would change probably the least is football. You just wouldn't make the playoffs every year.
You just wouldn't be playing in the GLIAC.
Yeah. And you certainly wouldn't be making the playoffs every year at that point either.
Right. Not every year like this, but you know, like in D2, that a lot of their team softball and whatever have been dominant enough that a move to FBS wouldn't be that big of a deal. And then even just to, I mean, for FBS, that's for football, but like for them to be a D1 softball program, they could go in and not be out of it for a MAC championship.
No. Yeah. Especially the MAC is a very weak softball conference, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Central wins it all the time and is in the regional, but outside of Central.
Yeah. And what Grand Valley, what made it to the College World Series this year?
Like three of the last four, maybe.
Yeah. Even. So I mean, I think if any sport could just, you know, slide right in and compete at D1 level, probably softball or women's soccer, maybe. Women's soccer might be a bit tougher, but still, I mean,
right.
They're final four bound every year, it seems.
Right. For sure. It would be interesting. It would be a couple years out. I don't know how that works with if they would need a new pool. I mean, I don't necessarily think they have a Division I pool, but I haven't been in there in a couple of years either. So, but they also have hosted a lot of their GLIAC meets and stuff at the Holland Aquatic Center, which is huge. So, you know, that might not be as big of a deal as I think. So, it'd just be really interesting to see because, Grand Valley, like we were saying, different sports, different levels. It could, and soccer. I mean, come on, soccer has been in the Final Four like 10 of the last 11 years or something like that. I mean, like that could be really interesting. So, change the dynamic a bit. So, and for local athletes, we get a lot of local athletes that go to Grand Valley. Like Abby Wynn from Zealand West is just signed to play soccer there. If in 2 years, the middle of her career, they go D1. That's a huge deal. And she's a D1 level kind of player. You know, people that have D1 talent a lot of times go to Grand Valley because they'd rather, you know, it's more fun to win than go to a D1 Big Ten team that's 1-11, you know, like, so that'll change a lot of things too, which will be interesting. So we'll see how that goes. High school basketball started last night as of this. Will, you were at Holland Christian.
Covenant
Christian beating Holland Christian, or Holland Christian beat Covenant Christian. they got a new coach. They got a lot, like a lot of new faces in the lineup. What did you see from them in their opener?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of went into this game fully I told Coach Levi Painter, his first year, he had been with the freshman team for the past 3 years, but he took over the program at the varsity level this past year. I told him before or after the game ended, I'm like, I fully expect you guys to get, you know, spanked around and beat pretty badly, because they were playing Covenant, who were a regional finalist last year, won the district, obviously, and had five seniors in their starting five, whereas Holland Christian had one senior on their whole roster, and she was not in the starting five. They had a freshman in their starting five, and I'm like, all right, this could get ugly real fast, especially considering Holland Christian came off like a 4-11 season last year. They weren't all that good. But no, I mean, this first quarter was tough. They scored 5 points. All of them came off of free throws. So they didn't make a field goal until about halfway through the second quarter. But then they got hot. I mean, Trina Vanderswag is sort of the girl who powers that team. She hit a couple threes in the second quarter and then just kind of exploded from there. I don't remember the final score of the game, but they won by, I think it was like 43-34 or something like that. I mean, they won by a decent margin in a game like that. Their defense played incredible all night, really fighting on boards. And Trina Vanderswag is going to be a girl to watch if she can keep playing like that, because she's the spark of that offense, and they really play tenacious. And then the freshman, Cameron Vandenbosch, I think is her name. Mm-hmm. She doesn't look like a freshman. I'll just say that she's like as tall as me, and I'm 5'11". Like she's tall, and consider she's already in the starting five of a varsity team, and she's only going to get better from here, one would imagine, is pretty impressive. So that's exciting to watch if you're a Holland Christian fan too.
For sure. For sure. And I was at Unity Christian. Zealand West beat Unity Christian in their season opener. Zealand West jumped out to a 16-0 lead, and then in the second half was behind. So it was one of the weirdest roller coaster kind of games that I've seen. But they figured out a way to right the ship, and that was through their defense. They did more pressure and they got a lot of transition baskets. They're not necessarily going to be a great shooting team, but Kara Bartels underneath, she's, over 6 feet, and she scored 18 points. And then everything else they had was pretty much on the run. I think they hit like one jumper, the whole game, but everything else was free, on the run or free throws after being on the run. And they got a lot of great athletes. I wasn't sure. They have a new coach as well, Ryan Lane, and they have a couple kids back, but their team did not do particularly well last year. And I wasn't sure. I thought this was going to maybe be a really down year for them, or a rebuilding kind of year. But they have like three athletes from the all area volleyball team that are apparently really well-rounded athletes that are juniors that I just didn't know were sophomores last year, like on a JV team or something, and or didn't play so much on a varsity team. And now they're all athletic. They got all kinds of athletes on that team. Abby Wynn, after a year off to focus on soccer, is back as well. And she's really good defender and brings a lot of energy. So, I mean, all of a sudden they went from maybe they've got one or two players to, wow, now they have six or seven, including a freshman who comes off the bench and plays well. They only have two seniors on this team as well. Three seniors. And it's just not what I expected at all, but in a good way. So this is going to be a better year for Zealand West than I anticipated. And it looks that way for Holland Christian too, which is really good for the area, because, across the board, the girls the last few years have graduated so much all-state talent. Obviously AJ Ediger from Hamilton is playing at Iowa now, and she's actually, as a freshman, seeing playing time, which is awesome. But, we got young players rising up.
Five team in the country too. It's not like they're just some random D1 team. Like they're a top five team, I think.
Right. Right. I mean, she hasn't played a ton by any means.
No, she has 2 points, but like still she's playing. Right.
But she's playing, and she's on a, on track to be a key contributor in the future for this team, which is really exciting. So, so it's the girls' season's off to a good start. We've got some good double local matchups coming this Friday. Zealand West and Hamilton play each other. Holland Christian and West Ottawa play each other. Black River and Fenville play each other. So it's a big first Friday night for local matchups. And then the boys season tips off next week, and we'll have full coverage of that next week.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's where we're at from now. I mean, a lot of the other sports are getting going, but we'll dive further into boys swimming and wrestling and hockey and hopefully cheer, you know, in the next few weeks. Yeah, we'll be back next week to talk about the Big Ten championship game, what happened with the Hall of Fame vote, break down some boys basketball coverage as well. So, yeah, get out and watch some basketball. The season is just beginning, and should be a very entertaining year. And we'll be back next week.